Janet Franklin. Today, I'm interviewing Edward Jackson. This interview took place on two different dates, March 9th and March 11th. Edward Jackson lives at 66 Camp Street. Edward, what time were you first in Middletown? What made you come? And how was the city like then?
I arrived in Middletown in 1942. The reason why that I came to Middletown, I came here from Brooklyn, New York. And the reason I came here was in search of employment. Things at that time weren't very good in New York City as far as employment-wise was concerned. And I heard of this wonderful state of Connecticut where they had defense jobs and defense factories, and the people were making such a large amount of money at that time, $55 a week. And I figured that Middletown, or not Middletown, but Connecticut itself would be the place for me to come in order to get employment. I arrived here in 1943, and no, last part of 42. And coming from Brooklyn, New York to a small town like Middletown, it took a lot of adjusting to do. In fact, the first month I was here, I couldn't sleep because there wasn't enough noise in the street. In Brooklyn, where you had a fire engine running by your door, a policeman siren blowing, that was all music to my ears at the time, and I was very used to it. But here, when I would hear the crickets out in the pond, I couldn't sleep because it was too quiet. Well, the employment situation in Middletown, for a black person, wasn't very good in the 1940s. This was just before the Second World War, and defense factories were just opening up. I can remember very good at the time when I went for employment around here that the people in this area, in the Middletown area, were very crannish. You had to be a native of Middletown before you can get any kind of employment. And you were a black person out of New York City. They took a very dim view of that. They were very suspicious of anybody that didn't come from the New England section, especially around Middletown or the Connecticut area. I know several places I went and put my application in, and I didn't get any results from it, and I come to find out later on that they weren't hiring black people in many of these factories around this area. I finally got a job in Meriden, and I kept it there. I worked there as a maintenance man for a while until I finally got a job as a machine operator a few years later. Then when I did eventually move back to Middletown, the first good job that I got here, I was working in construction, and I think it was when they was building the federal project out in Silver Street. I was working as a laborer at that time. Later, I began working on two or three jobs in order to supplement my weekly income, because I had a family living in New York City. I found out at the time that the black people that were living in the Middletown area, they were only two black people working in the factories in Middletown. One was a person by the name of Walmsley, and he worked for Wilcox and Crittenden. And Walmsley were a very old family in Middletown, been here for years. And Mr. Walmsley at the time had been working in Wilcox for quite a long time. The other person that was working in Russell Company was Mr. MacArthur. And the MacArthur families were natives of Middletown. And he had a pretty good job in Russell Company. Later on, when the labor shortage really hit Middletown, many of us were being drafted for armed services. Then that's when the opportunities opened up for black people for the various factory jobs here. And then they had to start at the bottom of the heap, mostly in the labor area. Speaking of conditions, I remember working in one of the factories in town where, now this was back in the 1940s, 1942 or 43, and we're talking about New England area. And I remember at the time that they had segregated bathroom facilities for blacks and for whites. And it seemed very strange for me to talk about that now, because it doesn't seem possible that during that time that these things were happening in Middletown. But it was so. A little later, the NAACP branch was formed in Portland, Connecticut, and it was combined with the people in Middletown. So it was called the Portland Middletown branch of the NAACP. And the reason why that this organization came into existence around here was because of the conditions that the black people in the area were experiencing from Middletown, in the Middletown area. And they did a pretty good job around Middletown. If I can sort of reach back to my memory and think at the time that the housing project was set up, there was no provisions made at the time to take care of the black residents in Middletown, those that needed housing at that time. And the NAACP and several prominent people in Middletown, I think Reverend Alton Johnson from the First Baptist Church, Main and William Street, Mrs. Cora Jackson from the Bureau of Social Agency, Council of Social Agency, and several members from the NAACP met, and by their insistence, black people were allowed to occupy two units in the federal project at that time that they had opened up in Middletown. And that was on State Terrace. And later, the same organization had to have several meetings with members of the Housing Authority and federal officers from the federal regional office in Boston in order to integrate the project entirely. Later, after several meetings, not only the project in Silver Street, the federal project in Silver Street, but all the projects in Middletown were integrated. In fact, at that time, the selection of members to go into the project, I think it was Lockwood Acres, was selected by Middletown Portland branch of the NAACP, and they were working together with the Housing Authority to make sure that the families that moved there were the families that really needed the housing and were briefed in certain regulations that the Housing Authority set down for occupants.
You mentioned the NAACP movement.
I'm curious whether or not this is indicative of cohesiveness in the black community and also some support from white residents in the area.
Oh, yes. At this time, the membership first was started strictly, only black people had first started this organization. And I happen to say that I was one of the charter members of it. In fact, I served for president for 6 years in the Portland Middletown branch and went on to become chairman of New England Regional, which took in the areas from Maine down to Connecticut. That was before the Connecticut State Conference branched off into their own conference. It was what is called New England Regional Conference. But here in town, in Middletown, we had very good cooperation from the white residents here, especially Wesleyan University, because we had many members of the NAACP that was working at Wesleyan as professors, as teachers. In fact, we had a few to serve on various committees, such as the Housing Committee, Employment Committee, and different committees that was a good working condition because, as I understand now, I can remember, the membership jumped from about 50 that we had to get in order to get the charter to around 450. And out of the 450, I would say about 250 were white people and about 200 were black people. And, well, this was the only organization that was really working for towards the advancement of black people at that time, except for, well, at the time they had a state commission. At the time it was called the Interracial Commission. And I think Mr. Frank Simpson at the time was the head of it. It later became the Connecticut Civil Rights Commission, and now it's the Connecticut Human Relations Commission. But at this time was was the State Interracial Commission. They were working along with us on many of the problems we had. But I want to state again that Wesleyan University was very instrumental in helping us to solve many of our problems because many of the people that were working there seeing the problems in Middletown and did work right along with the town people in order to clear up these problems here in town.
Problems that the black community had in Middletown, were they similar to the problems you left in New York?
In New York City, it was such a large place, and at the time I was living in mostly, it was a mixed area, black, Jewish, and Italian, at East New York area of Brooklyn. And even though we had problems, it didn't seem as though it was as bad as here because the problems here were exaggerated because it was a small town. And there just wasn't any housing for black people at that time. If you weren't a native here, you didn't own your own house, it was tough for you to get a place to stay. This was a typical New England reaction to outsiders coming in. And this was in the early 40s, the late 40s, and part of the 50s, and the housing situation was real bad. And the newcomers to Middletown, and there were many newcomers here, black people, that were the great influx here from the south, mostly from the state of South Carolina, around the areas of Pampa Cove, Florence, Timminsville, and that area. Many people came here from that area here, large families, and when they finally settled here, they sent back and got some of the other relatives, and they came here. So Middletown, it was a great influx of black people at that time that did come into Middletown. And this is one of the reasons why I believe that we had the problems of housing. It was hard for a black person to get a loan here or to build a house or own a house. In fact, when I came here, I left a family of two, my wife and two kids in Brooklyn, New York, and I worked up here 4 years before I was able to send down and get them and to have a place for them. I think that the first place that I got for my family was in the housing project at Long River Village. I stayed there for several years. But when I first come here, I was staying rooming in a rooming house down on Union Street, and we were men, all men living there, and as I understand, it's only about four rooms, and the four rooms that we had there, there was two beds to each room, and two men to a bed, and I got the guy who was being charged for $3 a week per room, something like that, you know, but I understand now that it was really, now you look back and you think of what happened, you know, you have to laugh that the room was such a small amount of money a week you had to pay, but you just didn't have any place to live. And so we had to bunk in with each other and share each other's accommodations. And in fact, I remember we were pooling, we were living together, so we used to pool our money together in order to buy food at that time. Because the work, even so, they did have work in the defense factories. It was hard for a black person at that time to get a good job in the defense factory. He got a job as a maintenance man or something in that order. But if he didn't have the experience as or a machine operator or some other experience that he really needed, it was hard for him to get a job there.
You mentioned that Wesleyan University was involved with the NAACP action that you had. And I was curious as to whether or not there was a continuous community interaction afterwards that grew out of that, or was there time which you can remember the university itself, or just some comments on that in particular?
Well, at the present time now, the cooperation isn't as great now as it was in the 40s and 50s and in the early part of the 60s. Of course, during that time, we had a great transition as far as people and ethnic groups in Middletown. At that time, it was a great influx of black people here. Later on, it became a great influx of Puerto Ricans. But the Puerto Ricans didn't stay long in Middletown and moved into Maryland and over to New Britain. But at that time, there was great concern.
In Middletown, you mentioned that employment was a great concern in the black community, and I was wondering, were there other institutions who also contributed to the problem, say, retail outlets or government, other government agencies or job outlets or Wesleyan? Since the two was a major institution in the city at the time.
Yeah. At that time, there was a problem in employment. I can't seem to remember too many black people being employed even Wesleyan University. I don't know whether the Coopers were the first ones to get jobs up there, but I know that now they, I don't know whether there's so many people employed there now. But I know at the time, I can't remember if it was any employment in Wesleyan as far as black people is concerned. We had a bad problem in Middletown as far as black people being hired in the retail stores and in the banks, post office, the police department, or the fire department. And I can remember at the time of picketing certain stores in Middletown, Main Street, some of the Christie stores in Middletown that was picketed at the time there. I don't want to mention names. I shouldn't mention names, but but along Middletown Main Street, if you were to go into the store in Middletown Main Street at that time, you did not see a black face there. And, well, maybe I was a little bit of a rebel at that time, because I see myself on the picket line. We picking these stores, picking in every one of these stores until they got some black representation in there. But they were getting our money, so I figured they should give us some employment. So the NAACP was behind that also. A lot of the history in Middletown, you'll see it be interwoven in what the work that the NAACP did at that time. And the at that time, the Connecticut Civil Rights Commission, they did a tremendous job here in town. And that was one of the reasons why that I found myself on the police force. There was no black people on the police force, no black people on the fire department, no black people in the post office, and like I said before, no black people in the banks or anywhere around in the main staff. And when the application came up for police department, I threw my application in. And I was selected and I got on the police force here. And that was quite a few years ago. I'm not going to mention how long it is now. You probably know how old I am. But I've been on now about 28 years in the police department. But we did have a labor problem. Of course, we have, in time of a recession at the time just before the World War and really after the Second World War, we had that little recession there, black people had to get employment. And that's one of the reasons why he was out there in a picket line working for that condition. But I think that if I can call back, there was a certain group that came up here from Florida called Florida Hobos. And it was a traveling baseball team. And I think these Florida Hobos, they came to Middletown, was one of the best ambassadors, black ambassadors, I believe, that it was good for the town of Middletown because it began to have whites and blacks to mingle with each other and understand each other. And I remember these Florida Hobos came up here and they got stranded in Middletown. And many of them got jobs in Wilcox and Crittenden. As laborers in Wilcox and Crittenden, we were working at that time on the galvanizing division on the kettle. And these fellows finally got housing here and they stayed in Middletown. Two men in particular, if some of the older Middletown residents would hear these names, they would recognize them. A fellow by the name of Fletcher, who used to play first base for Middletown Giants. And this was the integrated team at that time. The blacks and whites were playing together. And another fellow by the name of Baker, he could be nicknamed the Home Run Baker. And I believe that if they were at that time, if the color line had been broken in Major League Baseball, just a little before Jackie Robinson time, that Baker would have been one of the greatest major baseball player in New England region, in this New England region. Because Baker could hit a ball, he could run, and there was nobody who wanted to steal second base while Baker was the catcher. And he hit one of the longest balls that I had ever seen a man hit in Middletown. Over the flagpole at the city field, I think it's the Pat Kidney field now, but that's the longest ball I ever had seen any man hit. And he was really professional caliber as far as baseball was concerned. And there used to be carloads of Middletown citizens, white, black, all together, used to follow the Middletown Giants to the various cities like Essex and Old Saybrook, Portland, and all the cities around in this area that had teams. When the Middletown Giants were playing, they were carloads that would follow them to the different games. And it was really a very enjoying experience to see, you know, the people in this area get along so good together. And I think that the Florida Hobos, who later on they begin to play on the Middletown Giants baseball team, is one of the best, or some of the best black ambassadors to this area, because they seem to break down a whole lot of discrimination that was existing at that time.
Were there any community outlets for black youngsters during this time, the 40s and 50s?
Well, there wasn't too much opportunities for black youngsters. There wasn't too much opportunities for white youngsters because it was a small town. But black youngsters were accepted in the two schools at that time there, two high schools, Middletown High and Wilson High. In fact, two of my sons went to Wilson High and they excelled in football and also in basketball and in track. And there was a couple of other young blacks that really made a name for himself in Wilson, and then after they came out of Wilson. If you can remember, if you're reading about a book that was published by Horatio Strothis, he was a black author that graduated from Woodrow Wilson. Now, at the time, when before Horatio graduated, he was very prominent in track. In fact, we call him the one-man team because he carried Wilson off. In one of the track meets, he won medals in about 3 or 4 events. And Horatio, later on, wrote a book on the Underground Railway, Underground Railroad, I think. And the book was published. And he's no longer with us now. I think that he met with an unfortunate accident. I think he was drowned a few years ago. But Horatio was one of the products of Wilson High School. And we didn't have all this racial conflict in the schools that we have at the present time. Of course, this may be an overflow from the late 60s and the turbulent times we had then. But at that time, if you were black, you went to school, you would accept it. And your abilities were accepted. But Middletown didn't offer too much. I think quite a few of our youngsters that did graduate from high school left town to go to college or to go other places where they could get decent employment.
Excuse me. When the black students on Wesleyan University's campus, the numbers began to increase. Did this make any difference in relationships with the black community and the Wesleyan community or its image or whatever? Did that promote any type of community interaction that wasn't there before because it was simply a black community dealing with a white institution?
Yes, Wesleyan went all out in order to get black students to come here to study. And I imagine many grants were given to black students to come to Wesleyan and to pursue their educational desires here. And they had an organization called Upward Bound and other organizations that went into the town and to the town schools and attracted many young blacks to come in. And there was a sort of cap and gown relationship here between Wesleyan and the town, and with Wesleyan blacks and the town blacks. It was a good relationship that really did evolve after a while. As I said before, now it is not as much, even though we do have an Open Bound, we have certain other groups in Wesleyan that's working towards good community relations. But it seemed as though at that time it was more prevalent, maybe because it wasn't fashionable then to have blacks to go to Wesleyan. That was a new thing at that time.
Has this image been formed by a general trend, or is it based on specific type of interactions that have occurred?
Wesleyan had a very, very good image with the black community, and also with the Middletown people, because of the various programs that we did go into. And it seemed as though you would feel at ease in the Wesleyan University. And they even opened up many of their offices and classrooms into different meeting halls used to have. Of course, all other groups wasn't the same. I can remember an incident with the Connecticut Valley Hospital. As I mentioned before, that we had a great influx of blacks from South Carolina and Florida. I remember the incident where we had some female psychiatric aides, they came here from Florida and settled here in Middletown, and they had employment at the Connecticut Valley Hospital. And they had housed these women over top of a ward, and where they had the white psychiatric aides, they were being housed in the nurse's home. And of course, here was another job for the organization to begin working on. And we had several meetings, and it was resolved. But now, you know, they can live anywhere as they want on the campus, on the state hospital grounds, after we had several meetings there. And small things like this crop up once in a while. You remember these things, and this was back in the 40s and the 50s, because it just wasn't fashionable for black people to have jobs, and just enjoy all the accommodations that white people have in this area. But things have progressed quite a bit since that time. One of the things I didn't mention was the influence of the various black churches on his community. We had, in the beginning, we had...
I didn't mention that. That is the black churches were in town. The black churches had a very decisive impact on the area. Especially Trustee Aaron Zion Church. Now, Trustee Aaron Zion Church was a mother churchyard of all the black churches in the area. Something that many of us didn't realize is that this church is a very old church. It's the second oldest church in this area here, New England region, as far as black churches are concerned. In 1829, the Crossfield and Zion Church was on the campus of Westland, and later on they transferred this structure to Crossfield. And that's how the Crossfield site where it is now. But out of Crossfield and Zion Church came the Zion Baptist Church, the Pentecostal Faith on Main Street, Shadow Baptist Church, one of the largest churches in Middletown, on Buttermilk Street. All of these churches came out of Crossfield and Zion Church. And during this time, many of the affairs of the community were centered around the churches, and many of the young people at the time, most of their activities were centered mostly around the churches, going on different church programs, having call groups, different programs at different churches and on different town halls. And out of this, these churches, the young people that went off and went out of Middletown into other areas to get jobs, go to colleges and different places. Now, there was a great feeling of humanity in Middletown at that time, especially when they were building Zion Baptist Church. I can remember the men of Zion Baptist Church contributing at times, two or three days a week, and it's labor and their skills. And we had a man that was the head of the organization that would tell us just where to lay the bricks and where to place the plank, where to put the shingles on the roof. And these men gathered together and contributed time in order to put up this church. And if you know, if you've seen Zion Baptist Church, it's a beautiful church. And not only the men of the church, but the black men in that area, they contribute their time in order to help get this church built. And I thought it was a very, very wonderful thing. I can mention another incident in that during that time when the black businessman was put out of his place of business on Ferry Street. And the men got together then, the men in the area. Material was bought. There was somebody ahead of the whole building, the construction situation. And he would tell us or guide us what we had to do. And we dug the foundation, poured the foundation, and laid the brick, and put this man up a business of his own. And this business was put up on Summer Street, in the area, within the black area at that time. But a lot of this stuff has been lost now, you know, it's not the closeness, it's not now here like it used to be in a few years ago. When I say a few years ago, I'm talking back in the 50s now, the early 50s. Even in the early 50s, there was only one black officer on the police force. And for more than 10 years, they were still only one black officer on the force. But that wasn't only just Middletown. That was in surrounding areas the same way. In New Haven, they only had a very few black officers on the force. Now, of course, we haven't got as many, which I like to see, on the force, black officers or minority groups.
We got three black officers and one Puerto Rican. We have one black woman that now is our dispatcher here at headquarters. But the climate has changed very, very much here in Middletown. We have a young chief, Chief Eugene Ramey, who is open for change. He's a man that looked over the situation, and he's seen that it should be a change here in Middletown, and that we're going along with the times. And even a month or so ago, he advertised in the press, in the Current, and over WCNX, and over the Western station, WESU, for a minority group candidate to come in and put their application and try to become members of the police force. But we have blacks now in post office. We have blacks now, and did have one or two blacks in the fire department. Stores now hire blacks. They're in the bank and the offices. And Middletown is really progressing quite a bit. And I know I painted a sort of dull, sort of a very dim, dismal picture of Middletown, but I can't help that. I'm only relating history as it seemed to me at the time, and as a black person, how I was affected by it, you know, and what I thought about Middletown at the time when I first come here. Of course, we're going to have problems with housing. We're going to have problems with housing for a long time. Now, Middletown, the same as any other town, has grown pains. But now, if a black person or any minority group, if they have the money to buy a house, I don't see any bars at all that keep this person from going forth and purchasing a house if they want to. Middletown right now, not like when I first wanted to buy my home. At that time, a black person was going to the bank and asked for more than $3,000. They think he was crazy. But now, we have black people in Middletown buying homes in $40,000 up in that area, or higher. So Middletown has progressed quite a bit. And I have a very good feeling about the future of Middletown. Because I think our city has now come to grips with our problems. We have the city fathers that has come to grips with various problems. And I think that in the future, we have a very rosy future for Middletown. Even though I paint it as a dismal past, we have a very rosy future for Middletown. We have young people that are coming up, that are going to college, they're understanding the situation, they're going into different businesses of their own, and also into different administrations, some going into politics. We have a few blacks that then have holding positions in our city government at the present time. In fact, Councilman McRae at the present time is doing a very fine job on the council, and we have Miss Barbara Davison, who has served several terms on the Board of Education. So we have blacks that's really grab a hold of the situation, and they're going forward. And we have some blacks that have been head of other public offices. We did have Reverend Davidge, who's one of the first blacks that did hold public office here in Middletown. He was connected with welfare, I do believe, at that time. Of course, he has expired now, but did a very good job there. And so Middletown is really progressing. I'm looking forward to a very rosy future in the city of Middletown with all different nationalities and ethnic groups working together.